So we're going to be in Genesis chapter 9. So the last several weeks we've spent in Genesis, we've looked at the story of the flood. We kind of spent a week looking at the events that preceded the flood, what led up to the flood, and then spent that 1 week looking at the entire flood narrative. We see kind of the corruption and the violence and the evil, the wickedness of man. And we see a crossing of boundaries in which man falls again in the intermarriage of the lines of Seth and Cain. And we see the flood kind of an example of God bringing judgment upon the earth. God is judging those creatures that have sinned against him, have sinned against one another, that are worthy of his judgment. And through that judgment, God is actually bringing about a new creation. So we see God's grace to Noah, the righteous one, the one who walked with God. And we see God's preparation of Noah for a place that would carry him through the waters, that he would be kept safe in the ark as he sits upon the waters of chaos and destruction. And we see God rescue him and his family. So God is delivering. God is bringing an end to humanity, but he is delivering humanity through the life of Noah and his family. So what we're going to do now is we're going to talk about what happened when Noah exited the ark and he entered into a new world. So the chaos waters had collapsed. God had separated those during the creation days, and then he brought them back together. And he brought them back together in judgment, and then he separated them again. He remembered Noah, the beginning of chapter 8, and he remembered that he had promised to make a covenant with Noah, and then he breathed again, his ruach, his spirit. He brought a wind that caused the waters to recede, exposing the dry land and giving a place for man and animals to flourish. So when Noah steps out of the ark, he enters into a new world, a world that had been made by God, and then had been decreated by God, and now had been recreated by God. But there's certain things that have to be taken care of. How do we know, first of all, that the curse has been lifted? How do we know how things are going to continue? Are they going to simply resume into the same state that they were before the flood? And what confidence do we have that things will not, that things this time will be different? So those are some of the questions that we bring to us in the text. I'm actually going to pick up the last few verses of chapter 8 and then read all of, read chapter to verse 17 of chapter 9. So chapter 8, beginning in verse 20. Then Noah built an altar to the Lord and took some of every clean animal and some of every clean bird and offered burnt offerings on the altar. And when the Lord smelled the pleasing aroma, the Lord said in his heart, I will never again curse the ground because of man, for the intention of man's heart is evil from his youth. Neither will I ever again strike down every living creature as I have done, while the earth remains, seed time and harvest, cold and heat, summer and winter, day and night shall not cease. And God blessed Noah and his sons and said to them, Be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth. The fear of you and the dread of you shall be upon every beast of the earth, upon every bird of the heavens, upon everything that creeps on the ground, and all the fish of the sea. Into your hand they are delivered. Every moving thing that lives shall be food for you. And as I gave you the green plants, I give you everything. But you shall not eat flesh with its blood, with its life, that is, its blood. And for your lifeblood I will require a reckoning. From every beast I will require it, and from man, from his fellow man, I will require a reckoning for the life of man. Whoever sheds the blood of man, by man shall his blood be shed. For God made man in his own image. And you, be fruitful and multiply, increase greatly on the earth and multiply in it. Then God said to Noah and to his sons with him, Behold, I establish my covenant with you and your offspring after you, and with every living creature that is with you, the birds, the livestock, and every beast of the earth with you, as many as came out of the ark. For it is for every beast of the earth. I establish my covenant with you that never again shall all flesh be cut off by the waters of the flood, and never again shall there be a flood to destroy the earth. And God said, this is the sign of the covenant that I make between me and you, every living creature that is with you, for all future generations. I have set my bow in the cloud, and it shall be a sign of the covenant between me and the earth. When I bring clouds over the earth, and the bow is seen in the clouds, I will remember my covenant that is between me and you and every living creature of all flesh. And the waters shall never again become a flood to destroy all flesh. When the bow is in the clouds, I will see it and remember the everlasting covenant between God and every living creature of all flesh that is on the earth. God said to Noah, this is the sign of the covenant that I have established between me and all flesh that is on the earth. It's God's word. So basically, we're going to look at this passage of Scripture in two different sections. It kind of breaks up nicely to do that. We'll look at verses 1 through 7 that kind of describe God's blessing of humanity, His provision for humanity, and His protection of animals and man. And then the second half, we'll look at the covenant. We'll look at the covenant that God makes with man and the sign that He gives to assure us of that covenant. So what we're going to see here is we're going to see certain things that we've already encountered in the first few chapters of the Bible. We're going to see echoes of these things from Genesis chapter 1, Genesis 4, Genesis 6. We're going to see a deliberate repetition, I think, of those initial commands and descriptions and blessings that God has given to mankind. But there will be some modifications. So, on the one hand, what we're going to see is that the original state, the original commission, the original value that God has bestowed upon humanity and His created world is going to continue even after the flood, but it's not going to continue in the same way. There's going to be certain things that change as a result of it, and we'll just take note of those things as we work our way through this. What it does show us, though, is that the original value and vocation of man remains intact even after the flood. So if we consider the flood to be a decreation, God is destroying the world that He has made, we're also seeing a new beginning. We're seeing a new creation, and that God's purposes for humanity continue even after the decreation and recreation that occurs through the flood. What we see specifically is that God's initial command for humans to be fruitful is retained. It remains intact. We see God's bountiful, generous provision for His people, now to include not just the plants and the trees, but the animals for food. And we see His protection of animal and human life. So the very reason why we could say the flood happened, because of the violence and corruption that the whole earth was filled with, because all flesh was violent and corrupt, God is going to put some parameters into place to protect that, to demonstrate the value of life. And all of this hinges upon His covenant-making promise. All of it depends upon God making a promise and sticking to it. So that's how it ties into the second section. So let's look at this verse. Be fruitful, multiply, fill the earth. God blesses man and tells him to be productive. The initial command is prefaced by God's blessing. God blessed Noah and his sons and said to them, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth. The command is repeated in verse 7 at the end of the section, which kind of encapsulates the whole section and holds it together under the same theme. God's blessing and God's command for them to be productive, to reproduce, and to fill the earth. It's virtually the same command that we saw in chapter 1 after God made the man and the woman. He created them in His image, He blessed them, and then He told them to be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth. He added to that they were to take dominion and to rule over His creation. But this shows us this connection that's made between Genesis 1 and Genesis 9 shows us that God's original intention for mankind remains intact after the flood. Now, this command is commonly referred to as the cultural or the creation mandate. Interestingly, the word culture, the word that we use to describe culture, consists of three components. Just figured this out this morning, or read this morning. It refers to worship, so the cult. It refers to colonization, which means that we are spreading out. And it refers to the other thing I can't remember right now. I didn't write it down. It'll come to me at some point, and I'll bring it up. Oh, cultivation. It refers to cultivation. So there's this idea of we're going to worship God as His image bearers. We are to spread out and fill the land that He's created for us to fill, and we are to cultivate the land. We are to subdue it or to rule over it. That's at the heart of what it means to possess a culture. So when we are called, when it's called the cultural mandate, it's talking about those components. Now, there's debate about to what extent the cultural mandate remains in place, how other biblical covenants modify that or eliminate that or replace that. But at the heart of it, though, is this biblical reality that God's original vocation for mankind remains in place even after the flood. That's what I want you to get. I do think it gets modified later on with the Great Commission and other components and other covenants. And ultimately, this is fulfilled in Christ as He creates a people for Himself that fill the earth with His glory. But at the beginning part here in Genesis 9, what we're looking at is we're looking at God beginning afresh, beginning anew. Everybody wants a new beginning where the past is gone and the new starts again. Well, this is Noah's moment. Noah has been brought through the judgments, and now God issues His original command that was given to Adam, and Noah, like a new Adam or similar to Adam, is bestowed with this dignity and this value and this job. Fill the earth, reproduce, make image bearers, worship Me, and let My glory extend to the ends of the earth. So this original command then is prefaced by God's blessing. So when we see this happening, we should see it as an indication of God's blessing, which we see in the following chapter, where we have, from Noah, generations, we have 70 nations. God is blessing mankind after the flood to reproduce and to fill the land. They are to colonize it and cultivate the earth. Now, the second thing that we see along with God's blessings and command to reproduce and fill, another part of His commission echoes Eden, is that God provides animals for food for Noah and his sons. So we see this in verses 2 and 3. The fear of you and the dread of you shall be upon every beast of the earth, upon every bird of the heavens, upon everything that creeps on the ground, and all the fish of the sea. Into your hand they are delivered. Everything that moves, every moving thing that lives shall be food for you. And as I gave you the green plants, I give you everything. So God's blessing is seen in this reiteration of the cultural mandate in His provision of the animals for mankind to eat. Originally, if you remember, in the garden, God provided every plant yielding seed that is on the face of all the earth, and every tree with seed in its fruit, you shall have them for food. So God blessed the man and the woman. He charged them to be producing image bearers and to fill the earth and subdue it. And then He provided food for them to sustain them. Just as God provided food for Noah and the animals in the ark, He provided food for them to sustain them on the ark for the year that they were on it. Again, in chapter 2, we see that God provided trees that were pleasant to the sight and good for food. And God commanded the man to eat from every tree. Remember, that was the original command that God had issued. It was not simply a prohibition, right? It was a command. It was giving the man permission to eat from every tree. And then that follows, the exception follows that command. But the original command that God gave the man in the garden was to eat. Eat from it, all of you. Eat all of the trees that I provided for you. Eat freely from all of them. They're good for food for you. So God's generosity is displayed in providing the food for the man and the woman. The same thing we see here. God's provision of food for humanity is expanded now to include the animals as well as the plants and the trees. I think this is tied to man's dominion over the animals, and we could probably read into this a little bit too much. Maybe that's not. Maybe that's intended, and maybe that's important, but I think we can have the tendency to read into it thinking, well, they must have been vegans before the fall, and then after the fall, maybe they ate meat, maybe they didn't, became omnivores, and now they're carnivore. We don't really know what's happening here with that provision, but we see an expansion of it. The animals are for food. The animals, God has provided the animals for man to eat. Now, has their relationship changed? We can read probably back into the beginning of the flood and see that man's relationship with animals was different. It seemed to be different before the fall when Adam named the animals, when he exercised his rule, his dominion over them, not by eating them, but by naming them. And we see that God also judged the animals in which was the breath of life, because they were also possibly filled with violence and corruption. But here now, God doesn't make the animal to be food for man. There does seem to be some protection that God places upon the animals in bestowing fear upon them. So there's this instinctive fear that God gives the animals, so that when he commands the man to eat the animals, that tells the man that it's not going to be easy for him to eat the animals. These are not all going to be domesticated animals that simply walk right into your crosshairs to allow you to eat. No, you have to hunt. It's going to take some work. But the most important thing to note here is that there is a prohibition attached to this, right? God is generous. God is giving, and similar to what we saw with the trees in the garden, God is now actually limiting the extent to which they can eat the animals. They limit the extent by telling him not to eat flesh with its life, that is, its blood. Mankind is not commissioned or recommissioned here to be savages. They are not simply to eat animals that are living. And I think there's a tight connection here between the later Levitical practices of offering animals and their sacrifices to atone for sin. Now, what does it tell us that the life is in the blood, as Leviticus 17 says? It tells us that mankind does not possess it's interesting, because up until this point, you would think that the life was in the breath, right? God took out, he extinguished the animals and everything that had the breath of life in it. God breathed into the man the breath of life and he became a living creature. But here we have an example of the animal's blood. So what does that tell us? What does that connect us with? If you think back to the earlier chapters of Genesis. Well, it connects us, I think, to Cain, who killed Abel, and Abel's blood was crying out to God from the ground. His blood was crying out for vengeance. His life had been taken, and he was crying out to God for vengeance, which is the violent nature that we see duplicated in Cain's line, ending in Lamech, who killed a man and then swore vengeance upon anyone who would take his life. So what we see here then is that there's an introduction here to us that the life of a creature is actually in its blood. If you drain the blood from a creature, that creature is no longer living. Now, man does not have the ability to rule over life. Man is not commissioned to rule over life. That has not been given into the hands of man. That belongs again to God. So God gives this prohibition then to man not to eat animals that are living. They must be killed. They must be dead. Their blood must be drained before they partake of the food that is provided for them in the animals. Now this, of course, is going to see again, not just in the sacrificial system, but in the food laws that is given to the Israelites later on. This becomes an example for them, a prohibition, a law against them by drinking blood. If they drink the blood of an animal and they participate like the savage pagans do in eating these creatures, they are actually going to be cut off from Israel. The only sufficient use of the blood is for atonement. The only sufficient use of the blood of an animal in the Levitical system is for covering, for sins, for substitution. And it represents the life. The life of the creature is wrapped up into its blood. That's why blood can be used to atone for sins, because it represents the life of the creature. So blood is representative of the life of the animal. So when blood is offered, it's symbolic of the life of the animal that was given. It's sufficient for atonement, but it's inadequate source of food. So God provides for mankind by giving them the animals to eat, but they are not to abuse that. He makes it hard for them by having to hunt them down, but they are not to abuse it. Now also look at how he protects life. This is the third idea here in this first section. He introduces to us the concept of protection or value of life. Mankind is prohibited from eating flesh with its life still in it. Mankind is prohibited from taking human life. Animals may be eaten once their blood has been shed, but human blood is not to be shed at all. So notice what he says, "For your lifeblood, I will require a reckoning. From every beast I will require it, and from man. By man shall his blood be shed, for God made man in his own image." Now again, this echoes those earlier passages of Genesis. We've seen the echoes to God's creation of man and the command of man, to multiply and fill the earth. We've seen it in God's provision for man, the food now expanded out to include the animals. And we see a couple different things happening here. God's protection of man. In the new beginning, God puts parameters in place. They are intended to protect what is most valuable, that of the life of his image bearers. So let's just think about this for a moment. What led to the events of the flood? The wickedness of man, so intermarriage, the wickedness of man, violence, and corruption. Now, after the flood has wiped out everything except for Noah, his family, and the animals that were on the ark, God modifies his original command, and he provides some parameters in which man should live. And those parameters are designed, intended by God, to demonstrate the value of life. How does he do so? By requiring the life of one who takes the life of another. So for your lifeblood, I will require a reckoning. From every beast, I will require it. And from man, from his fellow man, literally his brother, I will require a reckoning for the life of man. So what we didn't see happening in the early chapters of Genesis is this concept. When Cain killed Abel, there was no sacrifice. Cain was allowed, by God's sheer mercy, to continue to live. When Lamech killed whoever he killed, he was allowed to live. And on and on and on, the violence simply intensified and expanded exponentially so that the whole earth was filled with violence. And there didn't seem to be this principle at work. When one life was taken, then another life is forfeited. And notice the language that's used. I will require it. I will require it. I will require it. I will require a reckoning. This is God's precept that he gives to humanity. Now when they begin again, God requires compensation when a life is taken. From a beast that takes it, God requires compensation, a life for a life. When a man takes it, God requires compensation, a life for a life. So verse 6, whoever sheds the blood of man, by man shall his blood be shed. For God made man in his own image. So here's the other interesting thing. The Vocation of man remains in place after the flood. The value of man remains in place after the flood. So God has bestowed upon man something unique that no other living creature possesses, that being made in his image. God has made man, male and female, as his royal priests. They are to represent him, and they are to reproduce by making more image bearers to fill the earth. That remains intact after the flood, after the fall. And God puts these parameters into place to protect, to show the inherent value of humanity. When one life is taken, another life is forfeit. That's why this command is there. Now, we can question whether or not this was intended to deter capital crimes, murder or homicide. And there's, of course, lots of debates about the way that currently works itself out in our society today. Most studies that I've seen, at least at the superficial level, would indicate that capital punishment does not deter things like murder or high crime. So if that was God's original intention, and if that was actually the case in reality, then we had to see, why is this command here? Why is this parameter given? And I think we could probably answer the question without saying that it was intended to be a deterrent, that God intended it to curb man's violent behavior, simply by saying that the purpose of it is to uphold the value of man. So the reason why we would be in support of something like capital punishment is not because that's the ideal, right? Remember, this is not a description of the ideal place of humanity. That's Genesis chapter 1. We're Genesis chapter 9. The fall has happened. Man remains wicked. He's wicked from his youth. And God puts these parameters into place because of man's wickedness. And if man is allowed to continue in violence like they did before the flood, without any sort of repercussions, then what does that say about the life and the value of human beings? So God puts this parameter into place to show us that humanity has inherent value. By requiring a life for a life, God upholds the value of his image bearers. This is the beginning of what we know as biblical justice. So we value life by taking life when a life is taken. We require a life for a life, and we uphold the value of mankind and ensure that the punishment fits the crime. So God gives this modification to humanity because humanity is still made in God's image. And he gives it so that man does not revolve into the violence in which precipitated the flood. Okay, so that is kind of the initial command. Those echoes into the earlier chapter shows us that these things still remain in place after the flood. But how are we ensured of that? How do we know that this continues? How do we know that this is still in effect for us today? I think that's what gives us to the next section. God encapsulates all of these things under the term covenant. This is now a covenant that God makes with man. God condescends. He gives promises. He issues commands. He enters into a relationship with mankind. Those things that we saw in Genesis 1 are still in effect with certain modifications. And now God assures us of that, affirms us of that promise by making promises to us. So God makes a covenant. A covenant is mentioned 7 times in verses 8 through 17. It echoes God's previous promise to Noah in chapter 6 that God would establish his covenant with Noah. And with the flood in the rearview mirror, Noah having offered a pleasing aroma to the Lord, God promises now to never again destroy the earth. So what makes that a covenant? Remember how important Noah's sacrifice was, right? Noah came out of the ark a worshiper. Noah came out of the ark not just simply trying to get away from his wife and his son's wives, his daughters-in-law. He came out of the ark and he worshiped God. He knew what God had saved him from. And he offers a pleasing aroma to God, and God's heart is changed. No longer is he going to destroy the earth with a flood. But the seasons will continue. You will reap, you will harvest. The sun, the moon will continue to revolve. You will have your seasons. Everything will continue. The rhythms of daily and monthly and annual life will continue. God has promised that, and he seals that promise with this covenant. So Noah exits the ark, offers the sacrifice. God makes the promise. Now this is important for us to understand because it's such a loaded biblical word, right? They show up everywhere in the Bible, covenants do. And they become central to the way in which the story of God unfolds. The story of God unfolds through covenants, through solemn promises or commitments that are undertaken by parties or that contain certain obligations. So God makes covenant with people, with human beings, with his image bearers. He condescends and he enters into an agreement with them. He makes promises to them, promises that in some ways simply place a burden upon him in order to fulfill those things, but also require something of his human counterparts, his human partners. They have obligations as well. Now this is the first one that's explicitly mentioned in the Bible. Many see a covenant with Adam in the garden because they see components of the covenant with Adam in the garden. But this is the first place it becomes explicit, and it's with Noah and his sons and the rest of mankind. What we see, the big covenants shaped in the biblical storyline, is that God makes covenant with Abraham, with the Israelites and Moses, with David, and then Jesus makes a new covenant in his blood. So we want to look at the concepts of the covenant here by looking at the details that are provided. What's the nature of this covenant? First, we see that the covenant is universal. So we're going to look at universal, unilateral, unconditional, and unending. So those are the four components of the covenant that describe for us its nature. It's universal. God establishes his covenant with Noah, with his offspring in verse 9, with every living creature that came out of the ark, the birds, livestock, and every beast of the earth, verse 10. The covenant is made with all flesh. Verse 11, 15, 16, and 17. And for all future generations. Verse 12. So the scope of God's covenant extends beyond that of Noah and his sons to all the living creatures and to all future generations. God's covenant with Noah is universal. Just think about that for a moment. God has pledged, he has covenanted with man, with animals, not to destroy the flood again, or not to destroy the earth again with the flood. Have we seen that happen since God made this promise for thousands of years? We've seen floods, we've seen tsunamis, we've seen destruction, but we haven't seen absolute destruction. The reason why we can sit here and we can enjoy what today is the hottest day of the year, we can with the peak of the summer season, the reason why we even have a season is because God has made a promise to Noah. He's made a promise to us. He's made a covenant. The reason why we can look forward to September when the temperature is cool is because God has made a promise that those seasons would continue. The reason why we are here today as human beings and God has not extinguished us with a flood of destruction is because God has made a covenant. God has been merciful. So you see that even our existence and our enjoyment of life and the cycles in which we live, the rhythms that we enjoy, is because God is a covenant-keeping God. He makes promises and he upholds them. It's not just limited to a certain geographical region in Mesopotamia. This is for all mankind, for all creatures of the earth, for all future generations. So we're given a promise here that extends out way beyond Noah and his sons, his immediate offspring, to us today. Now The second thing here is that God's covenant is unilateral. Probably not a word you guys use very much. The opposite of this would be bilateral, which is maybe like a better way to describe it because you're a bipod or you have two arms, most of you. So this is describing the nature of the covenant. It just helps us to understand the relationship that is between the covenant parties. You can't make a covenant with yourself. A covenant exists between one or more parties. So you have two parties. A unilateral covenant would be a covenant that one party says, okay, I'm making a promise to you, and it's on me to uphold those promises. I'm obligated to keep those promises, and what you have to do is nothing. I'm simply making a promise to you to do that. A bilateral covenant, which is where we see some of the other covenants of the Bible, places obligations upon both parties. So I'm making a promise to you, I have obligations to you, I'm pledging myself to you in a certain way, and you also are responding and promising things to me. You're promising to keep the terms that we agree to in the covenant. So this is different than that. Because God does not place any obligations upon mankind. God is entering into a covenant with mankind that he knows whose heart has not changed. They have remained the same even after the flood. Their hearts are still evil from their youth. Yet, because of Noah's sacrifice, because of the pleasing aroma that Noah offered up to God, of the clean animals that God had told them to bring onto the ark, God says, I'm going to pledge myself to you. I am making the covenant and all of the obligations are on me. This is up to me to keep. So this covenant then that God makes with Noah is that means that God has solemnly bound himself to humanity, every living creature, never to destroy the earth again with a flood. So this ties in with the next point that God's covenant with Noah is unconditional. God takes upon himself the obligations for the covenant that can't be broken by humanity. There's seemingly no obligations upon humanity for this covenant to remain intact. God doesn't say, I promise to never destroy the earth again with a flood as long as you promise to never fill the earth again with violence and corruption. No, if that were the case, then all would be doomed. Every generation would have a flood. It's hard to get anywhere if you're going to wipe out all of humanity every generation. So God promises then to sustain the covenant that he makes. Does it depend upon mankind? It can't depend upon mankind. In fact, when God enters into a covenant with mankind that they are obligated to keep, what do we see? They always break it. Over and over and over again. They are a disobedient, stiff-necked, hard-hearted people. That's us. Finally, the covenant that God makes is unending. It's universal, it's unilateral, it's unconditional, and it's unending. Verse 16 says, When the bow is in the clouds, I will see it and remember the everlasting covenant between God and every living creature of all flesh that is on the earth. It's an everlasting covenant. God's covenant with Noah extends to every living creature, all future generations, for all eternity. It's amazing. I mean, it's easy for us to kind of read over this and glance over it and not see the significance or the importance of it, right? It's easy for us to just read and say, well, that's cool of God to do that. Yes, we don't want to drown in a worldwide flood. Yes, we don't want to be destroyed by God's justice, a justice that we deserve. But we have to think about the fact that the only reason why we're here is because God made this covenant with Noah. And he's upheld it. Now what we see too is that covenants are accompanied by signs. God confirms his universal, unilateral, unconditional, and unending covenant with a sign. And the sign is, as you all know, the bow. Verses 12 through 17 describe this for us. But I'll read just verses 12 and 13. This is the sign of the covenant that I make between me and you and every living creature that is with you for all future generations. I have set my bow in the cloud, and it shall be a sign of the covenant between me and the earth. So God gives signs to point to promises. He gives signs to indicate covenants. Abraham is given the sign of circumcision. The Israelites are given the sign of the Sabbath. We, when we enter into a marriage covenant, we give the sign of a ring. The ring that you have on your hand is not the ring that reminds you of the promises that you made, but it reminds you of the promises that your spouse made. They pledge themselves to you and they give you a sign that represents their vows. The same way God gives signs to represent His promises. In fact, this sign is so significant, it's one that we can see, but the purpose of it is to remind God of the promises that He's made. So God has put His bow in the sky, in the clouds. When God sees it, He's going to remember His covenantal promises. But it's cool because we can see it too. If you're familiar with the language of Hebrew, you'll note that the word bow here is also, it's probably only used one other time to refer to what we would call a rainbow. That's when Ezekiel sees God's glory in exile, and it's shrouded in these colors, these magnificent colors. There's kind of this glass rainbow that God sits upon when He sees His glory in exile. Every other time that the word is used, it refers to the weapon of war or the hunting tool, right? So there's significance that it's attached to this, that people see that when God is giving the sign, what he's showing us in the sign is that God has taken His weapon of war and He's placed it up into the heavens now. And if you're familiar with the shape of the rainbow, you know that the rainbow is not pointed down at the earth, it's pointed up into the sky. So whether or not that's all intended to be wrapped up into the language that's being used here, you can't help but notice those connections. God is not stretching out His bow at the earth with a string taut, ready to launch arrows when man sins or disobeys. No, He's put it on the shelf. The string is loose and it's pointed away from the earth. So God's symbol then of His covenant to us reminds us that God is no longer at war. We are actually at peace. God has made promises and there's hope for us that things will continue as they are. Things will continue. The seasons will go on. The rhythms of life will go on. We will continue because God has made a promise. And when we see the storm clouds gather and we see the rain and we see the sun reflecting through the rain and the light that's created, we remember that God has made a promise and that gives us hope. He will never destroy the earth again with a flood. God has made a covenant and He's obligated to keep it. Of course, we can't look at this text without thinking about the way in which the rainbow is used today. It's impossible. As much as it's not really anything to do with the Bible, it's impossible to think about the symbol that God uses to show us the promise that He's made, to affirm for us the promise that He's made, to remind Himself of the promise that He's made, has now been taken, hijacked, and distorted to mean something completely different. No, I don't always respond to rainbows in the same way that I ought to when I see them, because now I know what they're being used for. Even looking at buying a pair of sandals, a rainbow brand sandals, I feel uncomfortable buying them because I don't know if it's gay or not. Or if people are going to think that I'm gay because I own a pair of rainbow sandals. So these are the conflicts that we have because of the place that we live, because of our time and culture, which it was clearly intentional when they adopted the imagery of the rainbow, they knew what they were doing. But sin takes what God has created and distorts it. And there's a brutal irony that they would take a symbol that's designed to have hope and use it as an affirmation of pride in a destructive, twisted, distorted, sinful lifestyle that God says is a result of His judgment. So, I like what one church did when they had a rainbow flag put out on the side of their building. And they put some words across the flag that said, "Proud to be delivered." And they used that, and they had a QR code attached to it so you could actually scan it and you could understand what their messaging was. And they used that to actually share testimonies of those who had been rescued out of the homosexual lifestyle, brought to repentance and faith in Christ, forgiven of their sins and restored. So in one way, I think that we need to take the symbol back and do things like that. So we've ordered some rainbow flags that we're going to put out on our building on the wall. Just joking. No, we haven't done that. But you could see that there would be to make you nervous. Yeah. I mean, you can see then, like, we're stuck in this weird conundrum. Like, what do we do? Do we have a rainbow shirt and we just turn it upside down? And we put a bow, an arrow on it, and we show the string that God is facing the bow back down? But no, that would be twisting and distorting the original meaning of the rainbow again. The thing is, we don't get to decide how God defines his signs. We don't get to decide what they're used for and what they mean. God gets to decide that. The same way that God gets to decide what it means for humans to be male and female. We can't take that and distort it just as much as we can't take the meaning of the rainbow and twist it and distort it to our own purposes as well. We have to receive what God has given to us. And that's what it means. And he's given it to all humanity. They're using a sign to promote something that is contrary to the Bible in hope that they won't be spared. And hope that they will be spared from God's judgment, if they even believe in a judgment. But they misunderstand the purpose of the rainbow. God gave the rainbow to say that he's never going to judge the earth again with a flood. God didn't give the rainbow to say that he's never going to judge the earth again, or the inhabitants of the earth. We know that he's going to. The flood demonstrates that. That's why the flood is even used. It's appealed to in the New Testament as an example of God bringing judgment upon the world. But I think we do need to have a heart change when it comes to it. We can't simply be repulsed by it, even though it is repulsive. We need to extend hope, true biblical hope. Hope that can reach those that are stuck in that lifestyle. Hope that can reach those that are twisted and distort God's original design. Hope that extends to those who take God's signs and abuse it for their own purposes. Hope for those who are worshiping a different God. So that's what our heart response should be. So okay, enough of that. What else should we see here? A couple things. I've already mentioned one of them. I think the purpose of this covenant, not only does it help us to understand our own existence, the only reason why we're here is because of the mercy and grace of God alone. The only reason why we're here today and why our neighbors are here today is due to God's common grace. The heart of man was not changed after the flood. But God's heart was, and he promised to refrain from bringing destruction upon humanity with the flood. We should rejoice in that. We should share that common grace. We should see our neighbors and ourselves as owing all to God. Everything, life, breath, rhythms, seasons, all of it belongs to God. It's his, and he keeps it going. But it also helps us to see a part of the biblical plan. God gave promises before Genesis 9. One of those promises that the woman would bear an offspring, a seed, and that he would be the one who would destroy the serpent. God gave a promise. How would that promise come about if mankind is destroyed? It can't happen. So God gives us an assurance that he is committed to his plan, that mankind will be allowed to continue so that the seed of the woman can come and crush the head of the serpent, and he can deliver us from the curse. So this keeps the story of the Bible going, right? things will continue. Even though mankind is sinful and corrupt, deserving of God's judgment, God is gracious and merciful, and He makes covenants and He makes promises, and He will keep the story going so that we can see the ultimate deliverer, so that Jesus can come and save us from the curse. He can come and He can give us life. He can rescue us from the serpent's grasp. He can destroy that evil serpent and cast him into hell. So God gives a promise. He makes a covenant that things will continue until Jesus comes. That there will be a deliverer, that His promise will stand. The seed of the woman will come and save us from the serpent. Let's pray.